May it please the court, I'm Russell McMaines, along with Mike Hatchell and Bill Reed, co-counsel for the petitioner Glenn Sulock. Hatchell will do the rebuttal and I will do the opening argument, probably because it seemed to be that it was a fairly simple posture that we had taken, both in the briefing and we think frankly on the facts of the case. Despite efforts to unduly complicate the case, it is largely an opportunity for the court to write on the enforceability and the enforcement of the employment contracts that were entered into in this case by Glenn Sulock with Texas Federal Savings and Loan Association. Frankly, as I purveyed the brief of the other side, I perceived that the principal argument made by the other side was frankly as almost imperceptible as the argument that was addressed by the Court of Appeals in Dallas. In a rather vain effort at humor, suggesting that the golden parachute provision in this contract never opened, the argument that is now made by the other side in their brief is that the Texas Federal Savings and Loan Association actually somehow disappeared in the course of a corporate transaction by some kind of magical transactional documents, and that that corporation is no more. The argument that is made for the first 10 pages of the briefing by the respondent is effectively that as a result of this rather complex and convoluted transaction, which is referred to generically as a reverse triangular merger, has resulted in, according to the Dallas Court of Appeals, the disappearance of the stock of the corporation that was the initial target, which is the employer of Glenn Sulock, which is Texas Federal Savings and Loan Association. Now, what I find to be particularly interesting is that the first 10 pages of briefing by the other side argues that, well, that's an employer because there is a difference in the merger agreement between the existing, as they define, association, which is Glenn Sulock's employer, and the resulting association, which is a supposedly new entity that has evolved as a result of this transactional mumbo-jumbo. And it has evolved and somehow is different than and not the same as the employer originally of Glenn Sulock. And that is precisely what their position is. They take us to task, in fact, for arguing that this is the same surviving association despite their express representations in the prospectus represented in Joint Exhibit 30 to the effect that, in fact, the association does survive. And why do they find that so significant? They find it essential to their argument in order to try and bolster this ridiculously gerrymandered interpretation of the employment contract, which talks about, essentially, a change of ownership as effectuating the rights of the golden parachute in the event of a termination following that period. In fact, an examination of the trial record reflects that they were sufficiently convinced that they were in trouble on this interpretation, that what they tried to do throughout the trial and what the trial is principally about is whether or not Glenn Sulock had been terminated at earlier various times prior to the actual transaction in question that was consummated, admittedly, incomplete and full on September the 8th, 1983. They kept saying, well, we fired him actually in April, and then they would come up with different dates as to when there was termination that had occurred in order not to activate the golden parachute. In fact, they had taken such steps at the time in April of the proposed merger. They actually presented to Mr. Sulock, as they did with the other executives, a modification of his employment agreement and stock option agreement to specifically exempt this transaction from activating it. And he refused to sign that agreement upon advice of counsel, tendered an alternative agreement to them which they refused to sign. Every other officer that was involved and retained by the corporation in the surviving corporation did in fact sign that document. It was represented in the prospectus that all of those people, including Glenn Sulock, had signed, although it was admitted in testimony that that was not true, and it wasn't true. When asked as to why they would tender an amendment to agreement, if in fact that did not trigger the precise golden parachute rights, which is for double his annual compensation in the event of a termination post change of ownership in the corporation. If that didn't trigger it, why did you try and get him to change his contract? I said, well, we were being cautious because it could well be interpreted that way. And they're right. It not only could well be, in our judgment, must be. In the judgment of the trial court, must be. In the judgment of the dissenting judge, must be. And the only argument that they can come up with now as their lead argument is that this isn't the same association, that the existing association as defined in the merger agreement, Texas Federal Savings and Loan Association, somehow disappeared and became a new corporation with the same name, doing business in the same location, and operating under the same charter, and not having notified anybody, their depositors or otherwise, that who they were doing business with disappeared, or otherwise securing a new charter or authorization to operate, their position is, well, we're different. Well, now, one thing occurs to me right off the bat, because this is an argument, really, that appears for the first time in the respondent's answer in its particular form, and that is that we sued, Glenn Seelock sued from beginning to end his employer, the signator on the employment agreement of Texas Federal Savings and Loan Association, as for breach of that agreement. And this party answered. And this party never denied that they are the Texas Federal and Savings and Loan Association that is a party to that employment agreement. And that is the existing, the surviving, or the resulting association. It doesn't matter what you call it. It is what it is. The hyper-technical argument which the Court of Appeals bought, in contrast, is even sillier, frankly. That is an argument that because of the reference of the triggering mechanism to the vesting of stock of ownership of more than 10% in other persons or group of persons, which is reasonably interpretable only as an alteration and change of the ownership character of the organization to trigger the golden parachute. The position was that, well, in this wonderful reverse triangular merger transaction, the stock of Texas Federal Savings and Loan, the quote existing association, never really vested in anybody because it disappeared. It magically ceased to exist. They wish to ignore the Court of Appeals, as well as our opposition, the testimony of their own witness, Bernie Carrico, toward the end of the trial, in which he admits that the parent corporation, TFSC, who is the parent and in which there is an exchange of stock by the existing stockholders of the savings and loan with this holding company, a new entity, that and Texas Federal Savings and Loan are different corporate entities. Admits that, number one. He admits, number two, that Texas Federal Financial Corporation owns Texas Federal Savings and Loan Association. Is that a change of ownership? Well, of course it is. The only facts are on the record. It's what the merger agreement says. It's what everything says. Now, his argument is, well, where there's no actual stock vesting. We have a burden, and really this is, if you look closely, what they're saying is, well, we have the burden to prove that the mechanism was triggered. We were supposed to go in and prove some way. We have failed to prove that the actual physical stock certificates were somehow transferred. And that's not really the issue at all. This is a person in the control of that corporation. They own it, whatever stock. And the truth of the matter is that both the prospectus and the merger agreement says that the stock that this parent corporation, the holding company, has in its subsidiary is magically transformed into all of the stock of the resulting association, which we know by virtue of standard pleading rules and otherwise is the same as, quote, the existing association. It is the party with whom our client has a contract that was in, no question about it, breached. That's what the findings of the jury related to, was whether or not there was any justification for these lame excuses about termination for cause. All of those jury findings are to the contrary. They're, of course, not the issue at this point in the Supreme Court. Rather, the question solely is whether or not this court is to ratify that
a stock can somehow disappear
in this transaction,
even though the association that results is the same, is the defendant, does not deny under oath or otherwise that it has the capacity to be sued in the very capacity it is sued, namely as the employer of Glenn Seelock and as the party to that contract. There is no question a breach in this case on the termination. And the jury found that it occurred after this transaction. And the prospectus in Exhibit 30 is just replete with evidence and indicia advising the shareholders of the new parent holding company what the differences in ownership of the parent company stock are and their rights under the federal, under the Texas Federal Savings and Loan Association. They aren't the same rights. They don't have the same rights because there are much broader rights given to the board of directors vis-a-vis the shareholders by virtue of that being a Delaware corporation that is a holding company rather than being a Texas Chartered Federal Savings and Loan Association. In fact, that's the whole purpose of this transaction in part, is to broaden the permissible scope of these activities of the holding company. It is to change its character and its structure. And our position from day one has simply been that the golden parachute provision was activated and that we were terminated without cause, and therefore we have all the rights we would be entitled to under the employment contract as found by the jury and the trial judge, which was double our annual compensation, and the annual compensation issued is answered in special issue number 6, and that resulted in the judgment that was entered by the trial court. And we have other points of error that relate to alternative relief, which frankly we think is immaterial because this is the superior relief to which we are entitled, and we think that we are clearly entitled to. The argument by the other side that somehow mystically that a person who owns a corporation as the resulting owner doesn't own whatever stock there is in that corporation, even though he owns 100% of whatever it is just absolutely ludicrous and insupportable. Not a single case cited for that proposition. Couldn't be. Doesn't make any sense. Didn't make any sense. The argument by the Court of Appeals was some strained argument of strict construction. It's not strict construction. It's absurd construction. Take the position that the, quote, resulting association doesn't have any stock. The merger agreement itself says that it has stock. Is it the same as the, quote, existing association? Right. It is the same. Has to be the same. And by virtue of their failure to file a verified denial, in fact, that they are the proper party in suit to this employment agreement, it is judicially admitted that they are the same. There is simply no question in this record. And on these agreements, which we agree and concede are unambiguous in their activation by this transaction, and in which the conduct of the parties surrounding the impending transaction, and particularly the attempt to extort from Glenn Seelock a signature on a revised employment agreement to exempt this transaction, which they did successfully extort from all of the other executive officers, evidences fully and virtually conclusively that that's what this agreement means and that it was activated. And then the question became how much. We believe that in the event, as we believe it's almost inevitable that this court, or certainly hope so, that a reversal occurs, we believe that rendition at this level is appropriate as well. Because the only issue that is argued as preventing that is with regards to the alleged cross points on having had factual sufficiency complaints about the amount of the annual compensation. There are references to 10 pages of briefing in the Court of Appeals. And if this court will examine that 10 pages of briefing and all of the arguments made therein, I think the court will understand that these are not arguments of factual sufficiency. These are arguments of matter of law contentions with regards to proper elements of damage. And they are properly disposable by this court as a matter of law. The arguments are made in terms, for instance, he's not entitled to the acceleration of stock options despite their own stipulation in the record. that had he not been wrongfully terminated, that he would have been entitled to such acceleration by the subsequent Bumbright merger and acquisition that occurred in February of the next year in terms of the announcement and agreement with the bank. There's no question. That's a stipulation. That doesn't require, and stipulations are not going to be subject to a factual sufficiency attack. All of the other elements of his compensation are virtually undisputed and actually established by records of the banks itself, many of which were introduced in documents by them. They're in no position to dispute that. We strongly suggest that a reverse and rendition is appropriate. In accordance with the trial court judgment, we submit that we are entitled to under the law and under just plain, simple common sense. There is no way that this association isn't Glenn Seelock's employer, isn't the surviving association, and didn't change ownership. It did. It's different. It's owned by a holding company. It's no longer owned by the former public shareholders. The only public shareholders, the only thing they own is stock in the parent corporation. It was an exchange transaction, a transfer transaction. It's done for tax purposes. And under all of those circumstances, there is no question where that stock went. And that is that it vested, whether or not it is the stock certificate physically or the right to its issuance, the control of the corporation vested solely in the holding company. That's a change of ownership. That activates the employment agreement's rights under the Golden Parachute Clause. The damages we submit are totally authorized by what is essentially the undisputed evidence, and we suggest that reverse and rendition is appropriate.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Occasionally, if you transfer stock, it also transfers all the physical assets that secure the stock. But sometimes corporations sell the assets, the physical assets, rendering the stock worthless. It doesn't carry the stock certificate with it when the physical assets are sold.
Yes, Your Honor. This is not an asset sale transaction, Your Honor. It's very clear on the face of the agreement. And the way that the reverse triangular merger works is that there is the entity which is the holding company. And the reason that it is created, and it's a Delaware corporation, and the reason the holding company is created because it can do more things legally, hold more assets, diversify its business operations than can a savings and loan association. But it can also own a federal savings and loan association, but it must have one that has a charter. And so it's not just a purchase of assets, it is a purchase of the entire entity. It is a separate, distinct, and existing entity. The prospectus says this, the existing association, is the survivor of the merger. What's happened is the holding company creates its own sub called New Texas Federal. New Texas Federal merges into the existing association, and the existing association is the surviving association. And then there is a stock exchange between the public shareholders for that stock in return for the holding company having issuing stock in the holding company itself. Clearly, the ownership attributes in total have changed, and the stock rights and ownership, both equitable and legal, of the Texas Federal Savings and Loan are now in TFSC, Texas Federal Financial Corporation, which is the Delaware Holding Corporation. And they own Texas Federal Savings and Loan Association, which nonetheless is an independent entity. In a transfer of assets, it would not survive as a legal entity. It did survive, and as one of the things that I added and pointed out, the argument that there is some distinction between the, quote, resulting association and the initial association is absolutely precluded by virtue of their judicial admission, since they did not deny that they are the party to the very contract that Glenn Seelock signed. So they're in no position to do that. We never really seen that argument crystallized until the response. Never had to make that argument before. It seemed to be perfectly obvious. But as they attempt to try and support what looks to me to be an insupportable Court of Appeals opinion, they've now shifted their positions once again, and that's what I was trying to articulate about that. But this association exists. It is not only an asset form. It could not operate in asset form because of the fact of its necessity for federal charter, for Federal Home Loan Bank Board approval. It simply had to exist as a separate entity, and does. The reason this is in fact called a reverse triangular merger is because the entity that survives is the original target and not the subsidiary of the acquiring corporation. Otherwise, it's in the lingo called a triangular merger. I suppose these things should all make sense to anybody who talks about contribution and indemnity as much as I do. But nonetheless, with regards to these complexities, it doesn't change the fact that the association in its initial form did survive. There's no new charter issue. No new places of business. It's continuing to operate, but it has changed its ownership character. And the rights of the stockholders in the holding company are not the same. They don't own the Savings and Loan Association at all. It is wholly owned by the holding company, and there are 20 pages in the prospectus of the differences in the rights of the shareholders. That these are different. And one of the big differences is the fact that there are much greater latitude for the holding company to dilute shares, dilute ownership interests of existing public shareholders by the issuance of more stock, which they could not do with the existence of it in the form of a savings and loan association. There are much greater and broader rights by the holding company, autonomous of the shareholders. There is clearly a change of ownership interest, which is our position as to what the golden parachute is triggered. Not sure if on all of that we've answered you to the court's question, but I agree that you could transfer assets only, but that's not what this is. This is not an assets transfer. It is clearly a merger into a merger of a subsidiary corporation of the parent into the existing association with its surviving. And whatever stock it has, and it actually refers several times in the instrument to it shall be converted by operation of law into the equivalent of the stock of the existing association. It actually changes the par value of the stock of its subsidiary that has disappeared and changes it back to the par value of the original association. So the whole point was that there's a party to a contract that has the control with regards to issuance of actual certificates. The question of vesting is a question of ownership of whatever stock they have and of the corporate entity, and not a hyper-technical question of we've got to go show that there is something physical that occurred, that the right to do it, and they own it as a matter of law, as a matter of the construction of the agreement by their own representations in the prospectus and the agreement.
Why wouldn't the holding company, there's got to be some, I guess, tax benefit all this. The holding company creates a new corporation that merges with an old one, and then becomes the owner of the old one through the merger.
Correct, good.
Why didn't he just go straight to the old one and buy enough stock to become the owner?
I'm not totally confident as to exactly what the tax differences are with regards to an acquisition directly by the parent, but I'm led to believe that there is a difference in tax treatment when you are talking about an exchange of stock for the parent with the stock of the other company under those terms. There is some reason why they are merged into a subsidiary that has to do with the niceties of the tax code. We've cited several articles that go into the details of triangular reverse mergers, or reverse triangular mergers, and triangular mergers, and so on. And as I say, those are all for tax purposes from that standpoint. But the truth of the matter is that there was an essential necessity of changing of the ownership of the federal savings and loan, and of converting the public shareholders to shareholders of the holding company only, which then had total and complete ownership rights as to the original Savings and Loan Association. And that had to happen as a result of what they were trying to do by virtue of the transaction set.
And you're saying that when the merger occurred, that triggered the golden parachute?
Yes. We're saying that effectuates the change of ownership, the transfer. The actual language in 6B talks about the vesting of ownership of more than 10% or more of the stock. Well, certainly 100% is more than 10%. And so that's not an issue. And that's what they have. They have 100% of all the stock this corporation can issue, and they have 100% of all ownership rights of the corporation to issue stocks, however much that may be. And that's all they need.
Perhaps you've already stated, but I want to double check, are the shareholders in the holding company the same people who were the shareholders in Texas Federal One?
Well, in terms of the same, you have to understand this is public Savings and Loan Association, so in truth and in fact, in terms of whether or not they are the same in the sense that maybe they changed at some point as a result of trading. You can't say they were the same individuals necessarily. It's the same amount of public shares, but they are traded at that particular time on the NASDAQ market. So it is not really, it is the same
share. Doesn't the employment contract call for a change in ownership of 10% of the shares in order to trigger the golden parachute?
Yes, it calls for a change of ownership, and there was a change of ownership because it's the parent corporation now that owns all of the stock.
But who owns the parent corporation?
Parent corporation is owned by the public shareholders with diluted rights vis-a-vis the holding company because it's a Delaware corporation. They now own a Delaware corporation or own shares in a Delaware corporation which has a capacity overnight to dilute its shares with regards to the issuance of further stock and other matters. And in fact, there's also a discussion in there about that this is another way to, that they have much more flexibility with regards to the creating new building parachutes for themselves, which in fact was done, which would discourage other hostile takeover moves. But there is no requirement in the contract, no purported requirement in the contract, that the particular change of ownership be one that is hostile, friendly, domestic, or otherwise. It is merely a question of structurally and legally whether there was a change of ownership, and clearly there is. His employer is now owned by a holding company. It is not owned by him, by the public shareholder. And that change occurred.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We will now hear arguments from respondents.
Mr. Robert Coleman will argue for the respondent.
Please, the court. I'm Robert Coleman from Dallas, Texas. I've represented the defendant in this case since it was originally filed. I was trial counsel and have been lead counsel in this appeal. My co-counsel is John Richards of my firm and Robert Payne of the law firm of Payne and Bendix in Dallas. Primary issue in this appeal is whether a former senior top executive of Savings and Loan Association, employed at an annual salary of $71,000, with only 10 months remaining on that contract, to recover in excess of $1 million as a result of being fired after the effective date, but was an internal corporate reorganization, which did not involve any outside third parties, but did involve the existing association and a newly formed Savings and Loan Association, both of whom were under common control, that of the public shareholders. In considering that issue, I think you should remember the stated facts that established that the reorganization we're talking about was solely for the purpose of setting up a holding company to give more business opportunities to the group previously involved. The reorganization did not involve one single third party. Everyone associated with it throughout was involved from the beginning to the end, and their ultimate relationship was unaltered by the reorganization. The reorganization did not, it is undisputed, cause Mr. Seelock to be fired. Mr. Seelock was aware of all of the facts concerning the reorganization and setting up of the holding company from prior to the time he was relieved of all abilities on April the 1st, 1983, until the reorganization became effective on September the 8th, 1983. And thereafter, when on September the 19th, he was fired because of his actions on September the 16th in asserting for the first time that the reorganization had caused the acceleration of the stock option. I think we start from this application knowing that contrary to Mr. Seelock's arguments, the trial court judgment cannot be affirmed. Seelock has conceded in the Court of Appeals that the judgment was in error with regard to prejudgment interest. The Court of Appeals has not ruled on all issues before it, including particularly those regarding factual insufficiency. But this court can and should, in this litigation, by affirming the Court of Appeals decision. I'll concentrate on point of error number one, which relates to the issues of whether or not the golden parachute was triggered. To the extent time allows, I will deal with a couple of other points.
Mr. Coleman, before you get into that,
yes.
If you would answer a question or two for me, I maybe say something to the other members of the court, too. Before all this started, when Mr. Seelock was happily employed to save Texas Federal Savings and Loan, his stock was publicly traded and owned by various members of the public.
Yes, sir.
Now, when this transaction took place, the holding company was created.
Yes, sir.
Now, that holding company is a new entity.
Yes.
As a new legal entity.
Yes.
Were any stock certificates of Texas Federal Savings and Loan called in, new ones issued? What occurred respecting stock certificates themselves?
Merger agreement provides, and it is a copy attached to your brief filed in this case. Merger agreements provide two things with respect to the stock of Texas Federal Savings and Loan Association, the existing association. Before your honor is subsection C5C of that merger agreement. This determines what happens to the common stock, the existing association preferred stock. The merger agreement says that upon the effective date, all outstanding shares of the existing association shall be converted into the right to receive stock of Texas Federal Financial Corporation.
Well, that stock certificate's ever issued.
With the
from Texas Financial Association.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they were sent to holders, former holders of stock of Texas Federal Savings and Loan.
Yes. Paragraph 6 of the merger agreement provides that after the effective date of the merger, each shareholder who now holds a piece of paper representing a right to receive Texas Federal Financial Corporation stock would surrender that piece of paper to the corporation and in exchange would get on a share-by-share basis a stock of Texas Federal Financial Corporation.
Was it one for one?
Yes, Your Honor, it was. In this case, not one shareholder exercised any dissent of rights. And as a result, each of those 1,500,000 shares of common stock and 200,000 shares of preferred stock were exchanged on a one-for-one basis.
Okay.
Surrendered to the corporation.
Okay, we've got the stockholder taken care of. Now, what evidence does the holding company have of its ownership of Texas Federal Savings and Loan as respect to stock certificates?
It has
a stock certificate for 1,000 shares of stock issued by the other association, which in the corporate structure was named New Texas Federal Savings and Loan Association.
So what we have here is the original and number one savings and loan association. We've got now a new holding company created under Delaware law. The original stockholders of the old Federal Savings and Loan have new stock certificates representing ownership in the holding company. The holding company has new stock certificates representing their ownership of both the old and the new savings and loan. Is that correct?
I'm not sure it would be fair to characterize that stock as new stock, Your Honor. The stock of New Texas Federal, the other association, was in fact in place immediately prior to the effective date
and had
already been purchased by Texas Federal Financial Corporation to become effective as of the date or the moment of the merger was effective. So this was stock that had previously been issued by New Texas Savings and Loan Association.
Become effective when they became in existence?
And it had been, yes. Upon the effectiveness of the corporation coming into existence, $1,000 that they had paid for that stock to put on the books. And so that stock existed immediately prior to the merger. And that is the stock through which the resulting association becomes the wholly owned subsidiary of Texas Federal Financial Corporation.
What happened to the original charter?
The original charter is of which entity
The original Savings and Loan Association.
The proxy or
the statement says that the charter goes forward with the resulting association. That is undisputed. So it has never been, never changed?
No, Your Honor, it has not.
And they're still doing business on that original charter?
Well, they were up until they merged with Bright Bank.
For purposes of this litigation?
Yes, Your Honor. For purposes of this litigation, the existing association's charter comes forward with the into the resulting association. The resulting association is a combination of the existing association and all of its assets and the other association and all of its assets.
And one of the assets that the original savings and loan provided was the charter to do business.
Yes, Your Honor.
And without that, did the newly formed organization have a charter to do business?
It might have been they have to have a charter, but the charter, which the proxy statement says is the charter of the resulting association, is in fact the charter of the existing association, Old Texas Federal.
Okay. Did the new holding company have a savings and loan charter issued to it?
The new holding company would not have a savings and loan charter issued to it. The existing association and the other association, Old Texas Federal and New Texas Federal, both had charters. When they merged, the charter of Old Texas Federal became the charter of the resulting association.
So that there was only one charter
after the merge, after
that, was under which anybody was doing business.
That is correct.
At all times pertinent to this litigation.
I believe that would be a correct statement.
Thank you.
Does the holding company own any assets other than the shares of stock in New Texas Federal?
Yes, Your Honor, they have some. They had some other companies which they also own.
This holding company that was created
out of
Old Texas Federal?
Well, a holding company is a corporation which owns the association. And it was put in place for the purpose of being able to acquire other assets.
Well, let me back up. I thought you told me that the shareholders in the holding company are the same on a one-for-one basis as the shareholders in Old Texas Federal.
That is correct.
Okay. All there was before was the savings and loan, Old Texas Federal. Then they convert their stock into the holding company. Right?
Yes. Well, yes, Your Honor. Their stock is converted into right to receive stock.
The holding company gains assets other than New Texas Federal. Is that what you're telling me?
For purposes of this litigation, the asset it has is the resulting association, which is the combination of the two associations, old and new.
But I don't know if the purposes of this litigation or not, but did they acquire additional assets other than one savings and loan association?
I do not believe the record reflects what they may have acquired otherwise.
Well, can you explain the Court of Appeals holding about the disappearance and the evaporation of this stock?
I think I can, Your Honor. What we're talking about here is legal disappearance. We're talking about what this paragraph provides with respect to the stock. The controlling law with respect to a merger of federal stock associations is federal regulations promulgated pursuant to the Federal Homeowners Loan Act of 1939. Those regulations are set forth at page 38 of our brief. They provide that for a merger to be effective, a merger agreement must contain certain things. One of the things that it must contain is a description of what happens to the stock. In this case, paragraph 5C of the merger agreement determines what happens to that stock. And this is the description of the disappearance of that stock. It doesn't vanish in the sense of some magical act. But what happens is that at 11:59, prior to the effective date,
on September the 7th, 1983.
That is,
they share a stock of all Texas Federal.
At 1201,
that same piece of paper had, by operation of law, ceased to be a share of stock of Old Texas Federal.
It had
become a right to receive a share of stock of Texas Federal Financial Corporation. That is the disappearance that the court is talking about.
Well, in actual operation, if that shareholder out there had not been able to produce a stock certificate representing his share in Old Texas Federal Savings, he'd think the new holding company would have issued him a new share in his company.
I think there are procedures for lost certificates.
Well, I'm talking about they want evidence of what happened to their share stock before they're going to issue another one, don't they?
Yes.
Well, now, I think it disappeared, and how would they have gotten a new share?
They walk in with a piece of paper that, prior to the merger, was a certificate
of
stock. Well,
we're talking about a substitute. We're all talking about the same
right
to receive the share of stock. And they don't have any evidence of that. Are you actually telling us they would have gotten a new share without any evidence of ownership in others?
It had just,
you know, gone up into the cloud and disappeared or whatever the city said happened to it. And I think that's the real problem that I have in this, and I'm sure other members of the court or anybody.
It did not disappear in that respect, Your Honor. The stock here, the piece of paper that was a certificate representing a share of stock in Old Texas Federal, the existing association, by operation of law, changed into something different. It looked the same. It had the same wording on it.
But
after the effective date of this merger, it was no longer, and the proxy statement makes that clear. The material cited in Mr. Seelock's brief make that clear. That after the merger, that stock certificate is referred to as previously representing ownership of a share in Texas Federal. It now represents a right to receive a new share in Texas Federal Financial Corporation.
And Texas Federal Financial Corporation now has in this vault all the previous share in addition to shareholders of Old Texas Federal Savings Bank.
I suspect they've destroyed them, Your Honor. The record is
as to what
happened to them once they came in. This language of paragraph 5 is one of the two agreements that this court needs to look at. And it doesn't have to look beyond those agreements to decide this case. Because the language of the merger agreement clearly shows what happens to the
outstanding
voting securities of Texas Federal
as a result of the merger.
Once you find out that they have been converted into something new, then you have to go back into paragraph 6B of the employment agreement. Paragraph 6B says that if the ownership of 10% or more of the outstanding voting securities of Texas Federal. It doesn't say if 10% or more of the ownership of Texas Federal. Mr. Seelock, for the years that this litigation has been going on, refuses to acknowledge the existence of these words. He wants this court, and he's wanted every court below, to ignore those words. They're in his agreement. He was the party involved in the drafting of this agreement. And those words have to be given meaning. They should be given their common meaning as the parties have understood it at the time they executed this agreement in 1981. And those words clearly mean the stock itself. Because the stock itself is capable of ownership separate and apart from the ownership of the company. I can own shares of stock. You can own shares of stock. Mr. Seelock owns shares of stock. Those are personal property of the public shareholders, and something had to happen to them in order for this matter, this paragraph, to be triggered.
Counsel, if it was so clear, why did the effort made to modify the contract?
The effort was made in April of 1983,
solely because this was a public corporation which needed to be certain that it had its paper trail complete.
I'm talking about modified contract with Mr. Hewlett.
That is what I'm responding to, Your Honor. April 6th letter, 1983, was offered because this is a public corporation and it needs a complete paper trail on any type of transaction of this nature. And that's what Mr. Williams, the former president, testified to.
It was not because we're trying to change the rights of parties.
No.
Counsel, what's your short answer, if you have one, to the proposition that the transfer of ownership of 100% of the stock exceeds that 10%, triggering the provision?
If ownership of the stock had transferred, I would say that it would be triggered.
But ownership of the stock did not transfer, Your Honor.
The ownership of 10% or more, or 100% of old Texas Federal, of the outstanding voting securities of Texas Federal, did not vest in any other person or group of persons acting in concert as a result of this merger. Because vesting requires that party to obtain rights, including, for example, the right of alienation.
Didn't the ownership change from the individual to the holding company?
No, Your Honor.
Did I?
Not the ownership of the outstanding voting securities. The ownership of the corporation, yes. Texas Federal, after the merger.
It is a corporation, but it's not.
In this case, we're talking of the outstanding voting securities held by the public. If we were talking about ownership of the corporation, it would have been simple to leave out those words.
Well, what was the holding of the corporation? Did the corporation hold any of its own stock? Was every share of stock held by the public?
There was other stock authorized, Your Honor, but all stock that was issued was held by the public, as I recall.
The record had been punished?
Yes. But the only stock that had been issued was held by the general public.
And then you're thinking that paragraph B was really drafted to protect from a hostile takeover, a merger?
The only evidence in this record regarding the intent of paragraph B at the time it was executed appears at about page 48, I believe, 44 to 48 of the record. It's testimony of the former president,
Joe Williams.
He testified exactly that the intent of putting in this provision was to protect against hostile outside takeovers.
Not the reorganization that would occur as a result of a change of ownership in stock. Isn't that why you have the golden parachute provision to protect skilled employees?
Right.
Reorganization that occurs after change of ownership in stock.
Yes, Your Honor.
In
this case, this provision was not triggered because the outstanding voting securities, the ownership of the outstanding voting securities, did not vest in any other person or group of persons.
Why did you want to reorganize the company after the new Texas Federal? Eliminate Mr. Seelock's
position. Seelock was fired, and that's because, despite the jury's feeling,